From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, we revisit our special broadcast marking the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's landmark anti-war speech, Beyond Vietnam, Time to Break Silence. Prominent civil rights leader Reverend Dr. Otis Moss reflects on racism and poverty in America. Author and journalist Jeremy Scahill discusses America's military policy, and we'll look at what's next for the civil rights movement with political commentator Dr. Mark Lamont Hill, Rashad Robinson, the executive director of the group Color of Change, and Ashley Woodard Henderson of the Highlander Research and Education Center. But first, singer and activist Harry Belafonte. He was the first African-American musician to win an Emmy, and his album entitled Calypso was the first to sell over 1 million copies. Mr. Belafonte was also deeply involved in the civil rights movement and used his celebrity to bring attention to the cause. He was a close friend to Dr. King, and he joins us now to talk about Dr. King's legacy and this speech 50 years later.
Mr. B, as always, sir, an honor to have you back on this program.
It's a good moment for me.
So 50 years ago, your abiding friend, Dr. King, was at the Riverside Church to deliver the most controversial speech of his life, Beyond Vietnam. And I want to start with just a quote from that speech and to get our conversation started, if I might. This is King in Beyond Vietnam. Men do not easily assume the task of opposing their government's policy, especially in time of war. Nor does the human spirit move without great difficulty against all the apathy of conformist thought within one's own bosom and in the surrounding world. Men don't easily assume the task of opposing their government's policy. So where did Martin find the fortitude to be so bold 50 years ago today?
I remember very distinctly the great struggle he had with making that speech. Many people thought it would be divisive. Mm-hmm. The fact that black patriotism is constantly being tested after experiencing a history of severe brutality and physical oppression and slavery at all. We were always looked upon for that moment when we will rebel against the state. And one of the ways in which that evidenced itself was by what was going on in that war in Vietnam. It was an unholy war. Mm-hmm. It was a war that should never have been. Once the French were defeated at Dien Bien Phu, one would have suspected that that conflict with the Vietnamese people would have ended, but it didn't. And rather than let it go, Kennedy, along with Johnson later on, stepped in and escalated our involvement in a war that was really a war of independence. Dr. King felt strongly that the Vietnamese people were trying to overthrow a burden of foreign domination. They were dominated by the Chinese. Now came the French for a very long period, a couple of centuries. And now America was stepping into this space under the banner of fighting against global communism. And the truth of the matter is that Dr. King felt strongly that the right to self-determination and independence was a right the Vietnamese people had earned, and that once they had defeated the French, they thought they had an open gate to a new state, mm-hmm. a new sense of independence. And he conditioned that reality along with the reality of the civil rights movement, because numerically, black soldiers were most in evidence during that war. We were the leading group in volunteering to be of service, and we were very much on the front lines. Mm-hmm. And Dr. King felt that that war was in direct conflict, not only with the historical interests of America, but with the potential that this nation had that it was never living up mm-hmm. to, which was what the speech at the church mm-hmm. did, why we cannot be silent mm-hmm. at this moment, why we should speak out. And he really felt that that was the critical moment for us in this movement, because it not only attested to our patriotism, mm-hmm. but it attested to our sense of morality, mm-hmm. our sense of decency, a sense of what should have been. And as it turned out, not only did we not win that war, but in the final analysis, the Vietnamese people have done exactly what they wanted to do in the beginning, which was just to state their own conditions, state the way in which they wanted to exist. What America did was to get involved in something that was not to our best interests. And what Black America did was to, in the final analysis, rebel against the war through the voice of Dr. King. And there were those who tried to make that as an act of the absence of patriotism, which was just not the case. But I think that the Black condition has always found itself in this place of ambivalence. On the one hand, you experience the kind of historical oppression we experience, and at the same time, we're asked to defend this country, right or wrong. And Dr. King took the position that I feel deeply committed to the ideals that America is trying to live up to, but I don't think that us continuing this imperialistic campaign is to our best interest as a nation. And Black people have a right to stand up because we're the first to die and the most to die in that conflict. And I think his position was a good one and a pivotal one for our movement.
It was pivotal and it was good from your perspective and the perspective of others. And yet, as you well know, that speech was not greeted that way by the press, by the body politic. They pushed back on Martin King really, really hard. People turned against him. He was ostracized. And the last year of his life, starting with that speech, April 4, 67, until they killed him, April 4, 68, that last year was fraught with all kind of tension and difficulty, as you well know. I wonder if you might share a bit about what those personal conversations were like once he gave that speech and all hell sort of broke loose. Because I know from talking to you many other times and having written about this that Dr. King could only confide in a few people, but he was pained, deeply pained, by the kind of response to that speech.
I think he anticipated, not to the extent that it turned out to be, but I think he anticipated that there would be a backlash and that it was not only an excellent moment for the opposition to step in and to discredit the civil rights movement, but to discredit it not based upon the credentials of our movement itself, but on the fact that we were being attacked for being unpatriotic in not standing with our nation at a time that it had entered into that conflict. Dr. King knew that our movement was at its most supreme, it was at its supreme test. If we could survive that moment where he felt it was morally imperative that America take a position, here we were in America fighting for our rights and fighting for our independence, for our freedom as a voice, as a people in a nation. And here were the Vietnamese fighting for exactly the same thing under their historical circumstances and conditions. And he was unapologetic, but he took great time to try to explain what the history of the Vietnamese. I don't think I ever knew him to be as studious and as focused on what to say as he was in the way in which he researched that speech.
And as you know, a very rare occasion, not just researched it, but a very rare occasion where he took the time to make the case, which meant he had to read that speech. As you know, he was such an expository speaker, but that night from beginning to end, he had to read it because he had to take the time to make that case that only he could make in that way.
Not only to make the case, but to make sure that he didn't miss the points.
Exactly.
He was great as an extemporaneous speaker. In fact, he very rarely spoke from text.
Right.
He had maybe short notes to keep refreshing him as he spoke in any given set of conditions and circumstances. But he was a great student of his cause.
Right.
And therefore, when he blended our domestic strife with the international scene, he found himself in a position that reflected the feelings of a lot of people in the developing world. His take on Africa, on foreign policy, mm-hmm. on the things that we were doing. He likened our struggle in Black America to be like the struggles of all peoples of color who are seeking to have independence in Africa, in the Caribbean, all throughout Asia. And he felt this automatic alliance, not to the, as a matter of fact, all of it was to the best interests of what America stood for. Mm-hmm. And he thought that he would gain, historically, the upper hand in that debate. I think history has proved him to be correct.
No doubt about that. 50 years after King gives this Beyond Vietnam speech and talks about the triplets of racism, poverty, and militarism, in your 90th year of living, what's the outlook? What do you see on the horizon for America as it continues to wrestle with this triple threat?
Oh, they're not youngsters. When I speak to people like Bryan Stevenson, mm-hmm. when I speak to people like James Bell, when I speak to a lot of young men and women in the communities of our nation, in the cities, and when I listen to young gang leaders who are in a transformative period, mm-hmm. they don't want the gang culture anymore. Mm-hmm. They're looking. I tell you that our countryside is replete with intelligent, bright young men and women who are prepared to step in to become the new Stokely Carmichaels, the new SNCC, the new Dot. There'll never be another Dr. King, but there'll never be another Jesus Christ. But every now and then we get lucky. and there are some in the horizon
yeah.
that are standing by waiting to step in to this space, which is quite empty at the moment.
And every one of us is doing our best to emulate you. Thank you for your grand example, and thank you for being a living epistle of what it means to live a life with courage, conviction, and commitment, and a life of character.
Thank you, Thomas.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. The Reverend Dr. Otis Moss Jr. is one of the nation's most influential civil rights leaders. He participated in many protests to end segregation alongside Dr. King, including the Montgomery bus boycott and the Selma Civil Rights March. He joins us now to reflect on the fight against racism and poverty 50 years after King's Beyond Vietnam speech.
It is an honor, sir, to have you on this program.
The honor is mine. Thank you. And thank you for all the work you do.
Thank you, sir. I had forgotten, as long as I've known you, I had forgotten that Dr. King eulogized your first wife.
Yes.
Officiated the marriage to your second wife. How did you and Dr. King become friends?
I entered Morehouse 6 years after his graduation. Mm-hmm. And among the first people I met happened to have been Dr. King's father, his mother, his brother, and his sister. And from that meeting, well, you could not go to Morehouse without meeting the King family. But after that introduction, we became friends. And Dr. King Sr. became Daddy King to all of us. And the friendship grew, and it grew into participation in the civil rights, human rights struggle. I met Dr. King in 1955, September, at a Baptist convention. Mm-hmm. Everybody was talking about and preaching and praying about the lynching of Emmett Till. Mm-hmm. That was the theme, that was the conversation. Officially and on the grounds and in the hallways. A few months later, the Montgomery movement was born. Fast forward, at my graduation, Adam Clayton Powell Jr. was the commencement speaker.
I'm just laughing because of all these connections, man. Adam Clayton Powell Jr. is your commencement speaker.
He yeah. closed his address. And we're talking about now 60 years ago plus, saying to us, this is 1956, mm-hmm. I want you to go out of here with a sense of mission. Martin Luther King Jr. is waiting for you to come and march with him. To some of us, that was a lifetime charge. And I can say, I say, with pardonable pride, some of us joined the movement and we have not turned back.
Mm. 50 years ago, Dr. King was in this city to give this Beyond Vietnam speech at the Riverside Church. The next day, all hell broke loose. Every major paper in the country came after him. For the next year of his life, it really was a living hell.
Yes.
He was disinvited to speak. These are the consequences of this speech.
Mm-hmm.
The consequences. He's disinvited to speak at black churches. His organization, the SCLC, goes bankrupt. They can't raise money. Hoover has plants inside of his own organization.
Absolutely.
They will not publish his book. They will not run op-eds. The last poll taken in his life, the Harris poll, found that nearly 3/4 of the American people thought he was irrelevant. Almost 60% of black people, his own people, thought he was persona non grata. The head of the NAACP, Roy Wilkins, the head of the Urban League, Whitney Young, both come out publicly against him. To the older blacks, they are mad at him for getting into a tete-a-tete with Lyndon Johnson, who's the best president black folk have seen since Lincoln freed the slaves, because he's passed the Voting Rights and Civil Rights Act. To the younger generation, he's passé. They want black power, Stokely Carmichael, Huey P. Newton, and the Black Panther movement. So Martin doesn't even have a constituency. He dies broke, essentially, and Harry Belafonte has to pay for his funeral. That's the story of the last year of his life. Now, I turn back to you, because I raise all of that to give people a sense of the hell that he had to pay for delivering that speech in New York City. Now you take us to the day he's assassinated, where the last phone call he makes is to his church to say, this is my sermon for Sunday morning, why America may go to hell. What do you make of the fact that after all that Martin had endured in that year since he'd given that speech, April 4, 67, they kill him April 4, 68, but that whole year was nothing but pure hell for him. And he still is going to leave Memphis to go back to Ebenezer and preach a sermon. After all of that, still has the courage to say a sermon,
yes,
why America may go to hell.
Look at 1967. He publishes his last book,
mm-hmm,
Where Do We Go From Here? Which, not incidentally, is taken from the last chapter of his first book,
mm-hmm,
Stride Toward Freedom.
That's right.
His book is published. He speaks at Riverside. He calls together a conference in Chicago of ministers across the country to expand the movement, focusing on economics and lifting up the three evils. He participates in mobilizing the Cleveland community for the election of Carl Stokes.
Mm-hmm.
He speaks to his staff and challenges them to remain faithful to nonviolence. And he lays the foundation for the Poor People's Campaign, mm-hmm, which is yet to be finished.
That's right.
All of this takes place, and I'm just naming a few things,
mm-hmm,
in the last year.
Mm-hmm.
So with all of the debilitating opposition, a foundation is being prepared,
mm-hmm,
for the next 100 years. And America and the world will be judged by these principles. That same year, 2 weeks before his assassination, he spoke to a congregation of rabbis,
mm-hmm,
introduced by his friend, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. And when Rabbi Heschel introduced him, he said something we should never forget.
Mm-hmm.
Martin Luther King Jr. is a voice, a vision, and a way.
Mm-hmm.
I call upon every Jew, and we can say all people, to hearken his voice, share his vision, and follow his way. The very future of our nation is dependent upon the impact of Dr. King, mm, That's a powerful statement against all of the ugliness, against all of the opposition, and all of the fear and the running away from him. Here is a prophetic rabbi who sees beyond that, and the prophet himself, Dr. King, is acting in what he called in his message a vocation of agony sometimes. He was participating in what we call service, suffering, and sacrifice.
Why is it that we are so afraid to wrestle with the complexity of who Martin King was, a man who could say, I have a dream, but could also call America in this Beyond Vietnam speech the greatest purveyor of violence in the world, and a man who a year later was prepared to preach that particular sermon, Why America May Go to Hell.
Absolutely.
Why are we afraid to wrestle with the complexity of who Martin was?
Unfortunately, it takes a long time for people to grasp truth. If you go to the memoir of Secretary McNamara, I believe about 28 years later, he makes a confession in the opening part of his book and says, we were wrong.
McNamara, very quickly, McNamara, defense secretary during the war in Vietnam.
Right.
Okay.
And he's confessing, we were wrong, terribly wrong. But it took 28 years, almost 30 years, a generation, for him to catch up with what Dr. King was saying at Riverside. Let's look at another example from history. How long did it take for a portion of the world to appreciate the ministry of Jesus? 50 years after the crucifixion and the resurrection, where were we in history in our response to truth? It took 300 years, and this may not be too encouraging, it took 300 years for a Roman emperor to give up and say, I think I want to do, whether he did it for political reasons or spiritual reasons. Constantine says, we aren't going to kill any more Christians. Someone after him says, well, you've issued an edict of toleration. We're going to make Christianity the official religion, which is dangerous, of the Roman Empire. And then another emperor says, no, we're going to beat that. We're going to make it the only religion of the Roman Empire. And Dr. Mordecai Johnson, the late Dr. Mordecai Johnson, says, at that point, the Christian church took off the robes of Christ and put on the garments of Caesar. And we have been in a struggle between Jesus or Christianity. So it will take a while for people to even appreciate the courage, the teachings, and the power of Martin Luther King Jr. Mrs. King said it would take at least 50 years, and that's generous. It is unfortunate that it takes us so long in the stretch of history to grasp what should be simple truth. Love one another.
Dr. Moss, I will close where I began. I am honored, deeply honored, sir, that you accepted the invitation to come and share your wisdom with us. Thank you.
I'm honored to be with you, Davis.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Dr. King called the American government the greatest purveyor of violence in the world in his Beyond Vietnam speech. 50 years on, does this statement still ring true? Joining me now to talk about this and more is investigative journalist Jeremy Scahill. He is the author of several best-selling books, including Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield. He's also the host of the podcast, Intercepted.
Jeremy, good to have you back.
Thanks for
on this
me,
program,
guys.
My friend.
I appreciate being
Before
here.
Before I jump into some particulars about this speech, you had a chance to read it, of course, a number of times over the years. What do you make of the parallels of the militarism, the anti-militarism argument that King made 50 years ago and where we are to now? I want to just kind of contextualize the parallels, and then we'll take off.
Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, if you really read the speech and you listen to it, this was a meticulous political analysis that was being offered by Dr. King. And it was like many sophisticated analyses, it was both prophetic and it was timely and timeless. He had a fundamental understanding of the connection between the war on the poor at home and the war on brown people and poor people and people of color around the world. If you look at our political context today, we have a president in Donald Trump who is gutting social programs and exponentially increasing the military budget. But what I think was the most fundamentally true aspect of that speech was that Dr. King talked about an American addiction to militarism that if it wasn't addressed early in the early stages, was going to flourish, and it has. We now are in 7 or 8 wars right now on the ground in Syria, Iraq. Those wars are getting worse. We've started a scorched earth bombing campaign that killed 1,000 civilians in just the month of March alone. We're ratcheting up our war in Somalia and in Yemen. And then we have our neoliberal economic war around the world. All of that was foretold in the analysis of Dr. King. And it's under both Democrats and Republicans. Obama was a very militaristic president, despite the fact that he was the first black president and campaigned on this idea that he was going to be the transformative figure in American politics. He started multiple new wars and intensified drone bombing. I think Dr. King's speech should be viewed in the context of how we've allowed this military-industrial complex to become the single most powerful entity in American society.
Since you made this reference to Obama and how wretched he was in many ways on war and on foreign policy, you recall, you know, 9 years ago when Obama got elected, there were people everywhere, certainly black people, wearing T-shirts that had Obama's face on it with Dr. King's face. And I tried to make the point then that Obama's a politician, King is a prophet. And we will see 8 years from now how Obama stacks up on the Kingian scorecard, racism, poverty, and militarism. We could have a whole show 8 years later on where Obama really stood on racism, poverty, militarism. What kind of grade do we give him? So you've already graded him on militarism. But what do you say to people, though, who have gotten lost in that relationship, that narrative that they want to run, putting King and Obama together and suggesting that Obama is the fulfillment of Dr. King's dream?
Well, I mean, outside of the fact that they were both incredible orators, both were black, and both won the Nobel Peace Prize, there's very few similarities between Dr. King and President Obama. President Obama chose to ascend to a throne that involved being in control of nuclear weapons. He had the authority to do everything he promised, closing Guantanamo, improving the lives of the poor and black people and other people of color in this country. And on almost by almost every metric, he failed, except the metric of comparing him to Donald Trump. And I think that people make a fundamental mistake by not allowing Dr. King's political legacy to be as complex as it actually was. Mm-hmm. Just simply quoting the I Have a Dream speech, it probably was one of the least powerful speeches that Dr. King gave. And I say that as someone who grew up as a student of his political writings and his speaking. If her true history was what was being taught and celebrated, that she actually was not some random old African-American who refused to go to the back of the bus, mm-hmm. but rather a trained tactical activist, would she be celebrated in the same way that she is today? If Dr. King's Beyond Vietnam speech or Why I Oppose the Vietnam War speeches, mm-hmm. if those were the speeches that were taught in school and not just the idea, I want my children to go play with white children, that's safe politics. Mm-hmm. Dr. King was not about safe politics, mm-hmm. and he paid dearly with his life because he did the unthinkable mm-hmm. in American society. He connected race, class, and militarism. And that's an epic do not do.
What about this notion of just war that Obama and others have tried to leverage? And essentially what they're saying is that Dr. King and nonviolence is a decent theory, But King didn't know Hezbollah. King didn't know Hamas. King didn't know. And so they suggest that his nonviolent notions wouldn't work in a world today.
Well, there's very little new in warfare except technology, and that's just a really oversimplified and I think inaccurate reading of the times in which King lived. If you actually even listen to the speech that we're talking about Beyond Vietnam, he's talking about the nuances of the National Liberation Front, about Ho Chi Minh, about the failures of Western colonial powers to make a peaceful deal that would have resulted in a non-aggressive, unified Vietnam. But King also, and this is why I say he was such an astute political thinker and strategist, he talked about the nuances of the factions that made up the resistance in Vietnam, and he talked about the minority communist influence within the broader context of resistance in Vietnam, and said that it was the United States and French that ultimately made them the vanguard of the struggle against foreign occupation. The same analogies can be drawn to Hezbollah and Hamas. The United States support for Israel is the chief driving support for the very movements that Barack Obama was talking about. Also, Dr. King's grasp of theology and of the just war theory was impeccable. And I grew up in a very religious Catholic liberation theology family, and I'm very familiar with the just war theory. And some of my father's friends who were theologians said part of the brilliance of the just war theory is that it limits it to almost no wars being just. And I think that King believed in the revolutionary nonviolence of Jesus as told through the Gospels, but he was a tactical pacifist. He didn't embrace pacifism initially based on a level of morality. The civil rights movement embraced it as a tactical means of confronting a well-armed regime that would outshoot it any day of the week. And so it wasn't simply just, well, Dr. King believed in turning the other cheek. He also believed that tactically the best way to victory against imperial forces with heavy firepower was to be willing to sacrifice your own life in a moral stance that also was politically very, very smart.
So what then do you make of the fact that this pacifist, Martin Luther King Jr., comes to New York 50 years ago, Riverside Church, and says that my government is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today?
Well, he was correct. Yeah. And, Russia right now in Syria is competing with the United States for the most ruthless killer of civilians in that country, and ISIS as well. But that's not good company for the United States to be in. And at the time that Dr. King spoke in 1967, the United States was engaged in its most intense napalming and scorched earth campaign in Vietnam, was increasingly engaged in a covert war in Cambodia, had overthrown governments in Central and Latin America beginning in 1953 with the overthrow of Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala, the overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran. You had then later the assassination of Patrice Lumumba. Mm-hmm. The world that King was looking at, it wasn't just about who's dropping the most bombs. I think when he said the greatest purveyor of violence on earth, he was talking about the lethal cocktail of the iron fist of U.S. militarism and the kind of hidden hand of neoliberal economic policies. I would say that the two most important speeches of that era were this speech by Dr. King, Beyond Vietnam, and the farewell address by Dwight Eisenhower, when he warned of the rise of the military-industrial complex. And what he was talking about was when you link corporate profits to an expansion of war and a proliferation of weapons, then there will be no incentive to pursue policies of peace. And that's why our political system is so broken, because it's bought and paid for by the war industry, both Democrats and Republicans. They have no incentive to cease wars. They have every incentive to find a nail for all the hammers that they're creating.
So 50 years ago, King said in this Beyond Vietnam speech that it is either nonviolent coexistence or violent co-annihilation. That's the equation that he put forth 50 years ago. What's the equation today? Or is he still right about that?
No, I think he is absolutely right about that. And I think that I don't think Dr. King could have foreseen the tremendous damage we would do to the environment in our world. I think if you take a look at the movements of hate that are being fueled right now, both in the United States and increasingly in Europe, the United States giving the impression that it's at war against a religion in Islam, the dangerous war games that are being played between Russia and NATO right now, and the moral bankruptcy of both the Democratic and Republican parties, along with the corruption of the Russian and Chinese governments. I think the world is on the brink of great catastrophe if we don't take very seriously a dismantling of a system that has corporate profit being placed over the livelihood and lives of humanity. And unfortunately, Dr. King's speech is as relevant and timely today as it was when he gave it in 1967. And it may have been one of the reasons why he was killed, because often a society will punish and kill and oppress the people that that call it like it is while it's in real time. And only later are they sort of realized for their brilliance and their genius, and in the case of King, his prophecy.
How then, against all of that, do you sustain your hope?
Well, because of people like you, because of people like the young people who've organized against police shootings of black people in this country, because of the undocumented immigrants who are very bravely coming out and standing in solidarity with one another, because of sanctuary cities that we have in this country, and because of the will to live that I've seen among people who live on the other side of our bombs. In traveling the world and going to war zones, it always strikes me at how kind people are, even though in some ways I'm an ambassador of the country that is obliterating their existence. The humanity of victims of war is sort of like taking away any permission I would have to give up. We owe those who live on the other side of the barrel of our gun, we owe them our struggle. We owe them our solidarity.
Jeremy, I appreciate you in more ways than one, my friend.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. We're going to look at what's next for the civil rights movement, where has progress been made, and what issues need the most immediate attention. To discuss these issues and more, pleased to be joined by Mark Lamont Hill. He is a distinguished professor of African American Studies at Morehouse College and political commentator for CNN. Rashad Robinson, executive director of Color of Change, and Ashley Woodard Henderson. She's the co-executive director of the Highlander Research and Education Center. Glad to have you all here.
Mark, when you first came to know this speech, what did you make of it? You went to Morehouse, where King went to school. What did you make of it? And what I'm really asking is, how did you compare and contrast Beyond Vietnam with what I'm sure you knew first, I Have a Dream?
Right, so I encountered King through the dream speech, like most people did.
Yeah.
Then when I got to 1967 and heard that speech, it changed the way I understood King, because now I understood him from a radical tradition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, coming up in a black nationalist tradition, I was like, we gotta fight back, we gotta think globally, we gotta, you know, struggle against imperialism. I found that in that speech. But the other thing I found was a moral analysis.
Mm-hmm.
King linked his faith in Jesus to peace, and he said peace can't be restricted to the United States, it has to be a global practice.
Mm-hmm.
When I saw that, I was sold on King, and I was also sold on a more global vision of activism.
Mm-hmm. Ashley, for those who don't know the connection between King and the Highlander Center where you work, tell us the story.
Yeah, so I mean, before there was a Montgomery bus boycott, before Rosa Parks sat down, right, there was a place in the middle of nowhere, Tennessee, where I'm born and raised, where folks came together across difference to train up, to share story and strategy. And it led to not only the Montgomery bus boycott, but it led to Dr. King coming back and leading other young people from all across the country, all across the southern region, in trainings on how to do this movement, this black liberation, this multiracial justice work.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a 21st century context, especially in the context of the 50th anniversary of the speech, Vincent Harding wrote it. That's Highlander people, right? Riverside got it, but that was a Southern story. And so many of us that are reclaiming MLK and the Movement for Black Lives tradition over the last several years, I think, like Mark said, are like, who is this man? Who is this man that stood out in a time where it was not cool or fun to be anti-war, to be pro-peace, to be connecting movement to faith, to be having conversations about the centrality of the South to a liberation fight, to be calling out white supremacy, capitalism, materialism, to be talking about militarization, is just something that I think many of us are trying to live up into, while also recognizing that for King to be able to say that speech took lots and lots of grassroots, regular, everyday people to develop the stories that are mentioned in that speech.
Rashad, let me start. I want to read a quote. Now, there are a couple quotes I want to read from this speech and get you guys to kind of unpack it, as you see it at least. But I want to give you the first bite at this. And this is a quote from the Beyond Vietnam speech in New York 50 years ago, delivered by Dr. King, of course. "These are revolutionary times. All over the globe, men are revolting against old systems of exploitation and oppression. And out of the wounds of a frail world, new systems of social justice and equality are being born." That was King 50 years ago. So I ask you 50 years later, whether or not out of the wounds of a frail world in which we live today, are there new systems of justice and equality still being born?
Absolutely. I think that there are movements continually being born that are rejecting some of the old ways of how things are being done, that are thinking about how we make deeper connections across other movements, but are also able to think beyond sort of the narrow idea of what is supposed to be civil rights. What's so powerful about King's speech for me is that he's pushing back against this sort of narrow idea of what his place should be, what he should talk about, what are black issues or not black issues. And, you know, at Color of Change, we are the only national black civil rights organization that doesn't take corporate money, right? And it's one of the sort of hallmarks of how we think about campaign work and how we think about taking on some of our activities. And every, you know, month, every 2 months, I get someone that tells me, you don't really know how to play the game, right? You all would be much more powerful if you knew how to sort of operate sort of within this sort of context without sort of a really deep understanding of what we are trying to fight, who we are trying to hold accountable, and at the end of the day, what power has to look like in the 21st century for black people. If corporations and media and government are not nervous about disappointing us, then we have nothing. And that means that we have to play on a wide range of fields. And we can't just think very narrowly about what are our issues or what are not, because we will consistently be the canary in the coal mine for a wide range of things that impact the country. You know, there's this saying that's been said so many times, and we oftentimes say it at Color of Change, that when America gets the coal, black people get the flu. And in order to deal with that, we have to be visionary about what we see as our issues, what we see as our cause.
Can I push back a little
bit?
Because I agree with everything you just said, except the first thing, right, which is the analysis of whether or not new systems are being born. We need new systems. I agree. My fear, and I'm a prisoner of hope, so I'm never saying we're going to stay here, but my fear is that we're trying to reform systems that need to be completely dismantled, right? So we're excited about healthcare, but it's really universal health insurance, right? We haven't really fundamentally dismantled the system, i.e. single payer, right? We're trying to get warmer and fuzzier prisons instead of saying maybe we could reimagine a nation that equates justice with punishment and punishment with confinement, that maybe we could reimagine the entire world so that universities don't look like multinational corporations. You know what I mean? And I know you're not saying anything different, but I think that was the King's point, is that we might have to reimagine the whole system.
King, of course, starts this speech by saying that there comes a time when silence is betrayal. The flip side of silence is obviously being vocal, but I worry, Mark, and I'm picking up your book here, Mark Lamont Hill's book is called Nobody, Casualties of America's War on the Vulnerable from Ferguson to Flint and Beyond. It troubles me sometimes, Mark, that not only are we too silent, but the only time we get vocal is when somebody's been shot in the head in the street by a cop. And there's so much more stuff between here and there that we ought to be giving voice to, that we ought to be speaking truth to power and the powerless about. Talk to me about this notion of being silent too often and only raising our voices when we've been shot by a cop.
I think that's an important point, that we can't just react to the crisis. And I think there's a question of voice, there's also a question of organizing, right? Because I think part of the problem is that we need more organized action. And I think the movement for Black Lives and some of the movements that have emerged since August 9th, 2014, and before, have modeled a certain kind of practice. So I think that, I don't want us to get shot by police. And I want us to be in the streets when there's an unjust shooting. But I also want us to register to vote, not to fetishize voting, but to be on the jury so George Zimmerman doesn't get off. I want us to build citizen review boards so that we can have some sort of oversight over police departments. I want us to fight for a different world, imagining a new system. I want a system where public defenders aren't privatized, mm-hmm. where the whole system has become essentially privatized. These are things we can do before the shooting, mm-hmm. so that when the shooting happens, we are organizing in the street and we're not just reacting, but we're kind of pulling from a tradition and from a system that we've installed ourselves.
And when the organizing happens well, we allow ourselves to have a more full picture of what we're advocating for. Because when our advocacy is really focused on get this cop prosecuted, which we do a lot at Color of Change, mm-hmm. and we're not doing the same thing about the fact that the majority of this system is about prosecuting people, not about letting people off. Mm-hmm. The majority of this is about expanding a prison industrial complex. And so when our most visible protest, when our most visible organizing is all about putting people behind bars, not about letting people out, or the uprisings, so it has to be about a larger conversation so we can sit in side of that, the conversation around state violence and how people are not held accountable, alongside of the way that the prison industrial complex has expanded, the ways that our communities have been treated, because people don't experience issues, they experience life. And racism affects people mm-hmm. from the, you know, a racist media has to help fuel the ways in which our criminal justice system operates. Corporate power mm-hmm. creates unchecked job discrimination, political inequalities, economic inequality, and so forth. And so on. So organizing is the way that we build the type of power that actually changes all of that. And focusing on sort of the whack-a-mole kind of uprising right. of this issue over this issue, it means we need structures that are focused on channeling that energy, not just providing spokesmanship.
And if the issues that you raised weren't bad enough, Rashad, what we are experiencing 50 years later, none of you were born when King gave the speech. I was just a toddler when he gave the speech. And yet our generation collectively has to deal with the intersection of race and poverty in a way that is as acute now. And I think in some ways, actually even more acute than it was 50 years ago. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what's real and pulling from what Rashad said is that for every one of those issues that could be raised, whether it's labor or worker justice, whether it's, you know, talking about Islamophobia and the dismantling of it, whether it's talking about this uprising and LGBTQ organizing across the country, that all of those are being led by some of the fiercest grassroots Black people I have ever known, mm-hmm. right? And so specifically when we're talking, it's so interesting to think about Mike Brown and Ferguson in the context of a conversation 50 years later about poverty and white supremacy, mm-hmm. because I can tell you that every time I was there, Fight for 15ers were there. Mm-hmm. I can tell you that every time I was there, the coalition of Black trade unionists were there, right? That there wasn't, that this idea that we must stay in lanes mm-hmm. Is actually the antithesis, is like the antithesis of what mm-hmm. Black liberation looks like. Mm-hmm. You can't talk about Islamophobia mm-hmm. and dismantling it and not talk about the fact that the majority of Islamic practicing people in this country are Black people, mm-hmm. right? You can't talk about labor and not talk about the disproportionate impact of chattel slavery, of wage theft, yeah. of all of those things on Black people. You cannot talk about a gender justice movement and not talk about Black women, cis or trans or mm-hmm. gender nonconforming folks who have led these movements. And so I think that as we, especially from a Southern context, think about what a 21st century movement looks like that gets everybody free, transforms the system so that we're also not recreating the problems mm-hmm. to impact other communities. What we're seeing is definitely an intersectional movement.
I look back on this and I know this so well as we all do, but it amazes me how young Martin, Stokely, all those guys were. And they were providing this kind of leadership that America needed.
It's a reminder that we need to reinvest in young folks.
Yeah, yeah.
That instead of looking for the next King, the next Martin, the next Ella, the next Asada, we need to assume that possibility is in all of our children and to raise them up to produce the next generation of fearless freedom fighters. And we're doing it right now.
Mark, Ashley, Rashad, love you all. Thank you for
appreciate
doing
you.
This. You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel N.C. Abwadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.